The Age of Enlightenment may well be called the Age of Lightning, for it is an era in which men throw lightning bolts at the absolutes or absolute values their fathers had established for themselves. A graphic representation of this era of lightning might well be one of Turner's paintings of a storm. The ship of mankind, or at least the Western world, is safely anchored in the harbor that men have constructed for it. There is no anxiety or fear, for the nature of the future has already been determined by piers of absolutes that have been set into place. But suddenly and without warning, the storm strikes, lightning blazes and thunder crashes, and the wind drives huge waves against the ship and the piers of absolutes to which it is supposed to be safely anchored. One after another, the piers collapse beneath the pressure of the sea, and the ship of mankind is gradually carried out into the unknown vastness of the ocean. Despair and hopelessness seize the hearts of men, but only for a moment, because a most resourceful man by the name of Immanuel Kant steps forward, analyzes the nature of the storm, and by a performance of one of the most brilliant miracles in the history of philosophy, succeeds in bringing peace and assurance to the hearts of his fellow men. The storm is weathered, and the ship of mankind is once again anchored in the harbor. But this time it is a new pier, a new absolute to which the ship has been moored. This is a melodramatic allegory, to be sure, but it is hardly exaggerated, for this is the picture of the Age of Lightning, the Age of Enlightenment. And if you bear this picture in mind as we proceed, you will better grasp the character of this era. And at the same time, you will have a profounder understanding of the contemporary scene and its relationship to the Age of Enlightenment. To understand this age in question and the role that it played and continues to play in the development of theology, philosophy, and science, it is necessary to ask ourselves the question, why? Why did the Age of Enlightenment dawn? What caused this movement to come into being? Once we have established some causal connections, we shall much more appreciate this often condemned and often misrepresented era. Speaking in a general way, the roots may be said to lie in the Renaissance. There men awakened from the dogmatic slumbers of scholasticism. Aristotle was challenged in all areas of thought. Nominalism, employing Occam's razor, sliced holes into the Aristotelian conceptualism and the Platonic realism of the scholastics. It maintained that universals are virtually meaningless because they have no objective reference. The external world is a world of singulars, of particular things, and one must deal with it as such. In this way, philosophy was beginning to address itself seriously to the problem of the singular, the individual. In close conjunction with nominalism, modern science was slowly established. Roger and Francis Bacon established the experimental scientific method, and for the first time since Plato and Aristotle, it approached the external world with an old but new tool, the mechanistic question. The teleological question, what purpose did or will this event serve, which had led science up a blind alley for 15 centuries, was laid aside. And the mechanistic question, what earlier circumstances caused this event, which was perhaps most successfully used by the ancient atomists, was now employed. It was no longer the why, but the how that was put under investigation. An application of this question to an investigation of nature caused chain reactions of scientific discoveries that have increased in scope and intensity rather than subsided. Through the Copernican Revolution, the hypothesis of heliocentricity became established. Telescopes, microscopes, and spectacles were invented. Gunpowder was introduced into the Western world. Gutenberg's printing press introduced mass production of books. And not the least, the Western Hemisphere was discovered, and the globe was circumnavigated. Almost simultaneously, another Copernican revolution was taking place in theology through the inauguration of the Reformation by Martin Luther. Thus, in the midst of such an eruption of thought and scientific achievement, it began to occur to the man of the Renaissance that it might not only be possible to control nature, but also to harness her and her forces in order to improve his own lot. This awakened sense of power over nature went hand in hand with a sense of dignity and self-sufficiency. Man declared his independence of all ecclesiastical authority and bygone tradition. and asserted his interdependence on science and society. Now, for the first time, man felt capable of confronting and undertaking the task of living alone. He was master of his salvation, and that salvation lay in his natural endowment to grasp the truth by reason alone. It is this factor that established the great age of rationalism. The age of rationalism represents a time in which man attributed absolute powers to his reason. Reason could uncover all reality. Reason could unify all knowledge and experience. In view of the new discoveries on the nature of the universe, man was once more interested in the makeup and construction of the world. What was the basic stuff of which all things are composed? To what common denominator could one reduce all experience? It is to this problem, the problem of metaphysics, that philosophy addressed itself. Without any reference to sense experience, man believed his mind was capable of solving the problems of metaphysics. The result was the construction of three outstanding rational systems of metaphysical thought. Descartes reduced the world to mind and matter. Spinoza, in an effort to establish a relation between these two realities that Descartes had not really been able to connect, set forth the real as substance or matter. This matter was self-caused and completely independent of all things. And Spinoza, an excommunicated Jew, but still a monotheist, ascribed deity to it. Leibniz, attempting to solve the problems that Spinoza's philosophy posed, conceived of particles of force, which in their subjectivity represented mind or spirit, but in their objectivizing of self formed matter or cosmos. These units of force were one, and he called them monads. He was bold enough to assert that his metaphysical construction solved the age-old problem of the relationship between mind and matter, and what is more, reconciled Plato and Aristotle. Science, as we have already said, had established a distinct empirical method of investigating the external world. The results were astounding, and science began to grow like Jack's beanstalk. In this way, man built up his security, and that security rested upon the powers of his reason to formulate the results of his empirical observations in terms of universal laws of nature. These universal laws of nature would show man exactly how the world about him functions. Having once established this pattern in which the universe behaved, man could establish certainty and security for himself as he moved into the void of the future. The result was that Laplace established a causal mechanical world picture which rested on unalterable laws, where nothing happens that is not already predetermined. For him, the whole future could be calculated in advance, and man could build his life and his world, as well as his security, on this absolute with the utmost confidence. Isaac Newton not only established the physics of absolute time and space, but formulated laws of motion by which his entire universe operated and to which it remained constant. In theology, the age of reason presents a similar picture. Truth, according to the 17th century dogmaticians, could be reduced to a system that, like the mechanical laws of the universe, would be valid forever and solve any and all the problems that might arise. So at the end of the 17th century, the mind, employing its genius of reason, had established an imposing array of absolutes. In philosophy, the absolute was matter. In science, it was a mechanical, foolproof universe. In theology, it was a series of theological systems that would solve all questions of truth. But this world of absolutes did not stand long. The age of lightning, or the age of enlightenment, suddenly shattered the master creations of man's mind. Philosophy, science, and theology had come to adopt the very tenets of scholasticism, which the Renaissance had rejected. As in scholasticism, the nature of the real had been constructed according to logical principles. The infallibility of the reason had been maintained. And without question, the power of the mind was supposed to be able to discover the true nature of anything and everything. Thus, the age of enlightenment commenced when the infallibility of the reason was called to account. It began in a questioning of the epistemological foundations and presuppositions of the metaphysics of the rationalists.
and it began in England, where it was carried on by three great philosophers who are referred to as the British empiricists. The question was not, what is reality? Rather now, it was, what is the nature and limits of the reason by which I seek to determine reality? So first and foremost, the Age of Enlightenment represents an inquiry into the nature of knowledge. John Locke was the first significant thinker in the school of British empiricism. He was born in 1632, and he moved epistemology into a new era by asking the question, are ideas innate? To answer that question, one first ought to ask, according to Locke, are the terms used to express ideas innate? Quite evidently not. Therefore, how can ideas themselves be innate if language is absolutely necessary to express them? The mind is really a blank piece of paper upon which experience begins to write knowledge. All ideas arise from the external world and are combined and separated in the mind to form complex and abstract thoughts. In this manner, Locke traced the course of knowledge from simple and complex percepts through and into simple and complex concepts. For him, the outside world consisted of two qualities, or two attributes, primary and secondary. The primary attributes consisted of bulk, extension, figure, motion, and number. The secondary of color, taste, smell, and sound. Only the primary qualities have reality, because they are objective and can be measured and determined without error. The secondary qualities, however, are subjective and present no means of absolute measurement or determination. Reality, then, for Locke was pluralistic in nature, composed of mind, the primary qualities of matter, and God. The second great empiricist was George Berkeley, born in 1685. He picked up the football of epistemology and carried it still farther down the field of skepticism. Not only are secondary attributes subjective, but it can be shown that the primary are equally so. Error is not only possible in the secondary qualities of color, taste, sound, and smell, but error is also possible in the qualities of extension, bulk, figure, and motion. If, therefore, not only the secondary, but also the primary qualities of matter are subjective, the world of matter can no longer be postulated. It no longer can be said to have an objective existence of its own. And if such a thing as matter or substance exists, I can never know it. All that is known to me are the attributes, which are nothing more than a series of percepts I have derived from my experience of the external world. What does reality then consist of? Reality can only consist of ideas and minds, God's mind and our minds. What is the origin of these ideas in the mind? The origin is the percepts I experience through my sense organs, percepts which are in the mind of God and are supported by Him. In this manner, Spinoza's objective absolute of matter was dislodged from its foundations. And science began asking itself the question, what is matter? A question which has brought us into the modern era of nuclear physics and quantum mechanics, where matter is defined as a series of events in time and space. The philosopher who carried British empiricism to its logical conclusions was David Hume. Not only did he deny the reality of God, but he also maintained that the mind was nothing but a stage across which the ideas moved. Indeed, there is only one reality, ideas. Hume also disrupted the world of science momentarily by setting forth the non-existence of causal necessity. When two things happen in progression, like stumbling over a rock and falling, one cannot maintain a consequent connection between stumbling and falling. One can only say that one is the sequence of the other. Falling merely follows stumbling. It is not the result of the cause of stumbling. One can only maintain there is a certain degree of association between any sequential event. This, of course, shattered the causal mechanical universe that Newton and Laplace had constructed in so beautiful a fashion. And until Kant solved the problem and saved the day, a day which lasted for more than a century, the anchor of this ship of mankind had no absolute to secure it firmly in the unknown future into which it was moving. Kant himself represents the transition from the Age of Enlightenment to the era of German idealism and Romanticism. He set philosophy and science on a new foundation by the construction of a new absolute, the a priori categories of understanding and forms of sensibility. And this he achieved by combining the two schools of epistemology, the analytic a priori represented by Leibniz and the synthetic a posteriori represented by Hume. The result was the unique hybrid of the synthetic a priori, which has survived into our modern era of relativity and quantum mechanics. Still greater skepticism was produced in France by this age of lightning. The thought of Locke, Berkeley, and Hume exerted great influence, not so much in the realm of philosophy, but in the area of political and social problems. This is the age of the deist Voltaire and the thoroughgoing materialist, the encyclopedist. In Germany, the Age of Lightning produced thinkers who devoted themselves to science, philosophy, and theology. Reimarus arose to attack the historical authenticity of the scriptures, and especially the New Testament. Not only had systematic theology of the 17th century foisted its formulations upon the interpretation of the Bible, the early church in which the books of the New Testament originated had forced its own thought upon the life and deeds of Jesus, and thus distorted the historical character of his person and work, so Reimarus maintained. After Reimarus died, the great poet, dramatist, and art critic Lessing carried on this criticism and became the father of the historical critical method. According to him, one must distinguish sharply between the original religion preached by Jesus and its later developments in the church. As a result, theologians were compelled into a quest for the historical Jesus, a quest which culminated in the book of Albert Schweitzer by that same name, which in turn became the foundation for present New Testament scholarship.